I'm Jessica Hunt. I'm a producer for The Exchange. And one of the things that we do when we are pulling together a show is consider how our listeners are going to tap into that subject. And we don't take for granted the huge engagement that we get. Emails, calls, social media, many ways that listeners engage with The Exchange. If you would like to financially support that conversation and support public radio, giving is easy to do at nhpr.org, or you can just follow the link right in the show notes. And thanks.
Support for The Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. For a small state, international commerce plays a big role in our economy. For example, more than 43,000 Granite Staters work for companies that are foreign-owned subsidiaries. Our export sector is robust, selling more than $5 billion worth of products abroad last year. And tourists from other countries are a desired demographic because they stay here longer and spend more money than day trippers from neighboring states. And so the trade disputes that erupted this weekend matter to the Granite State, and that's what we'll tackle first on our New Hampshire Economic Roundup today in The Exchange. Other topics for later in the hour, the forecast for summer employment, and a rash of mergers in the state with large companies gobbling up smaller ones. As always, let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our panel for the Economic Roundup includes Jeff Feingold, editor of the New Hampshire Business Review. Jeff, welcome back. Good to see you.
Great to be here, Laura.
Also with us, Brian Gottlob, principal of Polycon Research, an economic research firm based in Dover. Brian, thank you for being here.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Russ Tebow, president of Applied Economic Research, an economic and real estate consulting firm in Laconia. And Russ, good to see you too. Thanks for your time.
Great to be here.
Well, Russ, I'm going to start with you. So lots about trade in the news this weekend. It was almost hard to keep up. So let's start there. How important is the international commerce sector to New Hampshire's economy? And I'm not saying exports. I'm saying international commerce because there's a lot more to it than just us selling stuff to other countries.
Well, it's very critical to the state in three different ways. We hear a lot about the impact of trade on employees and losing jobs to China and whatnot, and that is one aspect of it. But I think for New Hampshire, a more important aspect is as consumers, the stuff we buy is a lot less expensive because of international trade. I mean, nationally, we're looking at about $2.3 trillion a year in stuff that we buy from other countries, and the reason we do it, it's less expensive for us. So shirts, electronics, television sets are all much cheaper. And that's a big aspect of international trade. And maybe for the average New Hampshire resident, that's the biggest aspect, that the stuff we buy is cheaper because it's made in places where labor is less expensive and other reasons as well. And lastly, then you look at employers and you look at it nationally and even here in New Hampshire. Being able to sell your stuff or manufacture your stuff overseas brings money into New Hampshire profits. What would Apple be if they didn't make the iPhone primarily in China? The iPhones, as expensive as they are, would be far more expensive. So you got to look at it three ways, not just one. As consumers, stuff we buy, as employers, the employers and business sector of the American economy, and as employees, which tend to get the most attention. And maybe if you look at the numbers, the employee impact, bad as it is probably a little less significant than the other two.
Now, what do you mean by that? The employee impact, as bad as it is less significant.
I think a lot of the day-to-day transactions that we have as consumers, as employees here in New Hampshire, the impact of trade on us is primarily in the way of the stuff we buy being less expensive. So as employees, now, New Hampshire did take a big hit in the decade of the 2000s in terms of jobs lost to China, and particularly in manufacturing of technology products. It just about wiped us out. But lately, manufacturing employment in New Hampshire has been rising despite trade situation. So I think the biggest impact dollar-wise in terms of the pocketbook of the average and wallet of the average New Hampshire resident, it's the fact that a lot of stuff is manufactured overseas.
So overall, can we say, and I'll sort of go around the table, so Jeff, you first, overall, can we say that international commerce, you know, be that investment or employment or trade or whatever, can we say that international commerce is a net good for the Granite State?
I think we'd have to. We'd have to. And I have to say something, just looking at a little more historical perspective. You know, New Hampshire, we went through a really terrible recession in the 89-91 era in the early 90s. And after that, a lot of businesses, especially New Hampshire manufacturers, were really, smaller ones, were really encouraged to go overseas and find customers overseas. You know, that was followed the NAFTA deal, and then there were other trade deals after that. So there was a concerted effort by the state and by business organizations to really encourage all these manufacturers go find customers overseas. You know, obviously we've had a long-term relationship with Canada, but Mexico became another area. Europe became a much more. We'd see governors going on trips to different parts of the world.
Germany and Ireland are big trade partners
yes.
with us here in New Hampshire.
Yep, absolutely. And then China opened up. So this is something that we've been encouraging as a state to diversify the economy to make it less susceptible to just specific, you know, recessions. And, you know, and I think that in looking back at it, it has worked. I mean, it's and these companies have really worked very hard to build up this infrastructure that we have, this international trade infrastructure, which is something we really need to pay attention to and think about as we consider what's going on. In the trade disputes we've seen exactly that's been going on, and especially instigated by the Trump administration.
Well, it's interesting to hear you give that history, Jeff, about the concerted effort in the early 90s to say to New Hampshire manufacturers, large and small, yeah. Hey, you know, look overseas. And I'm always struck when I look at the numbers at how robust New Hampshire's export sector is.
Yes, it's very, very much so, and it's a lot of it does have to do with companies that. Previously, let's say 25 years ago or so, you know, there's huge exporters like BAE Systems.
Sure.
But smaller companies have been working very hard. We've covered these people. They go to European tech shows, manufacturing shows. They go to Asia, and it's not just these gigantic companies doing it. These smaller firms that say, you know, we see opportunities overseas.
So, Brian, net good or net bad in international commerce here in the Granite State?
The only people who think that international trade and international commerce are bad, the only way you can think of it as bad is if you think after decades of filling American shelves with lower, everyday low prices and dealer lots with lower price cars, that somehow the U.S. consumer has been spoiled and they need to face a situation where they're paying higher prices for everything. That's the only possible way you could think that international trade and international commerce are bad. Clearly, there are people and there are jobs and industries that have been affected. Russ talked about the 90s in New Hampshire. You know, in total that decade, we lost about 30,000 manufacturing jobs, some of them because of international trade, some of them because of technology changes, et cetera.
Automation changes that meant you needed fewer workers to run the machinery.
But, you know, a million consumers benefited from the international trade by paying lower prices for almost all the goods and services that we produce.
Russ?
Yeah, I was just going to say, looking at some of the numbers, in 2017, New Hampshire firms exported about $5 billion worth of stuff, which is around 7 or 8%, something like that, of the state's GDP. So it's a big deal. Exports as a slice of the New Hampshire economy are big. And as Jeff pointed out, a lot of it's machinery, BAE Systems, airplane components and whatnot.
Components, yeah.
So, but $5 billion is a lot of money for the state in terms of exports. So, anything that disrupts exports, meaning tariffs, maybe, will have a negative effect on New Hampshire. The kind of tariffs that we're thinking of imposing, steel and aluminum immediately. I mean, almost everything has steel or aluminum in it at some point.
Well, could we unpack that for folks a little bit? Again, in terms of the impact here in New Hampshire, you know, you hear about tariffs on steel and aluminum and you think, okay, well, we're not Pennsylvania or Ohio, so, you know, who cares about tariffs on steel and aluminum? I mean, should we care, Russ, about tariffs on steel and aluminum?
Well, if you buy a car, if you buy a washing machine,
So the components will get more expensive.
The components will get more expensive, and therefore the finished product that we buy. It's true, we don't manufacture hard steel per se, but a lot of our machinery industries utilize steel. So a lot of our producers utilize steel.
Brian?
I'll give you a concrete example. We talk about steel and aluminum, but lumber. Lumber from Canada, 21% tariff was placed at November of 2017. Since that time, lumber prices have risen about 42%.
Whoa, 42%. So if you want to rebuild your back deck, it's going to be costly.
I don't know if you do any of that kind of work, but if you've been to a lumber yard, take a look at what's happened. Now, overall, just in the last year, it's been almost 70%. Some of that had to do with transportation networks in Canada, but 42%, that adds, just National Association of Realtors says it adds about $6,000 and $7,000 to a price of a new home just because of those tariffs.
Yeah, and something else that we have to think about is that we have a lot of businesses in manufacturers in New Hampshire that use steel in what they make. And actually, we did a story on this about a month or so ago on whether these companies are aware of the steel tariffs and the aluminum tariffs have affected them yet. And at the time, they weren't clear yet, but they did say one thing: even just the threat of tariffs building up over the last few months has caused people in the United States, their competitors and them in the United States, to hoard steel and aluminum. Basically, we have to make sure we have enough. So that's already raised the price of aluminum and steel.
Oh, that's interesting.
So then now that tariff's taken effect, then it's going to be even higher.
Did you want to jump in, Russ?
I did have something. There's so many numbers when it comes, figures available, data available to someone like me when it comes to trade, that you can easily cherry pick some numbers to point almost anything, to prove almost anything. Well, one thing that caught my eye is that, of course, there's been a lot of discussion about the Canadian trade, which is our second biggest trade partner, is Canada, next to China. But Canada imposes a 200%, 250% tariff on dairy products. And our dairy farmers are having a real struggle. And if that tariff, that's already there, that's there now. And it's not a response, it's something that was there. So that hurts our dairy industry. So it's
they
kind
must
of
be
a,
really upset about that in Vermont, where the dairy industry is
there you go.
And super
in,
important.
In New Hampshire, I mean, you can hardly keep a cow alive, It's so bad in terms of the economics of the dairy industry here. So maybe if Canada wasn't doing that, we wouldn't have as much distress within the dairy industry here in New Hampshire.
But to on the other side, as Brian points out, we've had the tariff on the softwood, and that affects producers in Canada. So nothing's in a vacuum, and I think that's what a lot of the concern is with this whole debate over tariffs, is that we're focusing on one little thing, when actually, from what I understand, if the United States had agreed to be part of the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership, that tariff that Canada was imposing on our dairy products wouldn't exist anymore.
Right. Yeah. It's really there's a lot of complexity here. It's easy to get lost in the weeds, and depending on what sector of the economy you are in, the weeds are real important.
Mm. So. All right. Well, I want to ask all of you about other forms of international commerce that really affect us here in New Hampshire besides trade. Let me remind our listeners that you can join us 1-800-892-6477. Today in The Exchange, it's our New Hampshire Economic Roundup, and our topics this month include the impact of trade disputes on us here in the Granite State. A little bit later, we'll look at the forecast for summer tourism. You can join us on these topics, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, the email, exchange@nhpr.org. So, everybody but Brian, to you first. In what other ways does foreign commerce affect our economy here in the Granite State? We've talked a lot about, products like steel and lumber and dairy, but what other ways does international commerce affect us?
Well, one of the biggest ways is through international investment, the purchasing of not only companies and businesses or the location of companies and businesses in New Hampshire, which has been very significant, and particularly over the last couple of decades, but also, and maybe less so in New Hampshire than in some other states, big investment by Chinese in real estate, particularly in larger cities. If you go to to Boston, or if you go out on the West Coast, you'll see a tremendous amount of investment. They're purchasing of U.S. government treasury securities. You know, the international economy finances a good portion of our annual deficit and our total U.S. debt. So those are all things that are indirectly affected. You know, if we get into a trade war with China, what happens if they, one, first decide not to buy Boeing aircraft, which is, you know, the world's largest aircraft producer? Well, that will we'll lose about, overall in the U.S., over 100,000 jobs. New Hampshire, because we have some very big airplane parts manufacturers, GE, BAE Systems, as well as some smaller instrument makers, we would be affected by
that. Wow, that's the trickle-down effect.
That's the trickle-down. So there's a number of ways, rather than just directly New Hampshire companies selling products internationally, that we will be affected. And you know, if the Chinese just decided they don't want to buy U.S. Treasury securities anymore because we gotten into a trade war, now that would be an extreme situation. Or if they decided to sell the Treasury securities that they hold, that would have big implications for our fiscal policy. Yeah.
Jeff, a Plymouth State University study from 2016 found 43,400 Granite Staters employed by more than 400 foreign-owned subsidiaries, like right here in Little New Hampshire. I was surprised by that.
That's 7.7% of basically the workforce of New Hampshire is owned. The people work for companies that are owned by foreign entities. You know, that's like, as we mentioned, BAE Systems many times. There's companies like Freudenberg up in the Bristol area. They're all over the place. TD Bank is a Canadian bank, and you know, Santander is another one. And I mean, it goes all over, all across every sector. And this is something that, you know, this is how New Hampshire over the years has become a very, very much reliant on just the international economy. We're no longer this little state that, you know, we're building
competing with Massachusetts
and textiles. Exactly. Or even worrying about jobs going down to South Carolina. That doesn't exist anymore.
Do you think people realize the extent of foreign involvement in our economy?
I don't think they really do, especially when it comes to New Hampshire. And actually, one of the things that this study found from Plymouth State is that New Hampshire is the third most reliant on foreign ownership of their companies per capita of any state in the country. And that really says a lot, because I really don't think that we understand that. You know, you go to, I believe Shaw's is owned by, right. is a foreign-owned company. That, you know, that's a supermarket people go to every day, and I'm sure they don't even think about that.
Well, and some people might hear what Jeff just said, Russ, and say, wow, that doesn't sound good. I mean, don't we want our companies and our people employed by, you know, Americans?
Well, I think to some degree it would kind of be better, as Jeff was talking. I think that you would have all the administrative jobs that run with New Hampshire Ball Bearings is a firm that is in the Lakes region where I live.
Yeah, big, important manufacturer.
It is,
for the state.
Owned by a Japanese firm. And some of the management firms are, I believe I'm right on that.
Yes, you are. Okay,
thank you. You'd have more management positions, marketing positions, financial oversight positions, and this is the kind of thing that has hurt, I think, the economies. Now, the jobs are excellent. They can't find enough people to fill them. So the firm is doing very well, and who knows, maybe without the Japanese investment, the firm would be struggling to a great degree, and they're not only in the Lakes region, they're also in the Peterborough area,
right.
I think. So it's a mixed blessing, I think, at the bottom line. On the one hand, it's nice to have their capital involved. On the other hand, I think that there are a lot of better-paying jobs that might be here in New Hampshire if they weren't foreign-owned. And I mentioned that firm. I don't mean to pick on them. They're a good firm.
Sure. And BAE Systems and Freudenberg, as Jeff mentioned.
Markham and Maj is a major employer in Keene.
Right, exactly. Well, okay, so trade involves, gentlemen, as you know, not just the flow of goods and money, but the flow of people. Here in New Hampshire, I'm talking about tourists, and I'm talking about university students. So we will cover that after a short break, and we'll talk about summer employment and some of those visas that allow foreigners to come here and scoop ice cream in the summer. All that's coming up. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, it's our New Hampshire Economic Roundup. We've been talking about how trade disputes affect our state. We'll turn to summer employment in a moment, how companies and camps are finding staff this year. But just to stay on this international commerce theme for a few more minutes, because it's a lot to talk about. And also, of course, let's hear from you, your questions or comments about the impact of foreign commerce on our economy right here in New Hampshire. Welcome, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. So Jeff Feingold, Brian Gottlob, Russ Thibault, just a little bit more about trade. As we said, it's not just the flow of goods and money, which we talked about earlier, but also the flow of people. And I think to you first, Jeff, international tourists are often described as a great demographic for our tourism office. Why is that?
Well, because they spend a lot of money and they're here for a long period of time usually. They don't just, they're not here for a day trip. And
they don't wake up and say, ooh, the weather looks bad in New Hampshire today. I'm not going.
Exactly. And, you know, they book in advance. And I know that it's been, there have been efforts by the state and others to market overseas, especially, I know leaf peeping season is very popular. And they have buses that come in filled with tourists from other parts, other countries, who just come to see foliage that they can't see anywhere else. I mean, this is a big deal, New England, and you know that's a major marketing. I'm not quite sure the numbers how many people visit every year, but I know it's very significant, and I know that also that it's the kind of thing that people in the hospitality industry like, because they can kind of plan ahead. Because
sure,
they're not making their mind a day before to come up.
Right,
they know who's coming. They know their rooms are being filled. They know that the restaurants are going to, they'll be eating at the restaurants. This is a major source of income for the tourism industry.
Well, and of course, Russ, let's talk about the Canadians. I mean, they're our number one international source of tourism. Obviously, you go up to the White Mountains, you see, you know, those Quebecois license plates everywhere. Hampton Beach, you hear a lot of French spoken. So, what impact do Canadian tourists, in particular, have, Russ? And what impact, if any, might this spat between the U.S. president and the Canadian premier have on these Canadians visiting? I mean, I'm guessing if they want to go to Hampton, they're going to go to Hampton, but...
They're going to go to Hampton. They are, yes. I think it's a significant element. Not so much in the Lakes region, I don't think. You know, living there, I don't feel the impact as when I go to Hampton Beach, for example, and hear a lot more French spoken and the license plates, although this week in the Lakes region, which is Motorcycle Week...
Some Canadian license plates on the
motorcycle. A lot of Canadian motorcycle license plates floating around. So it's big, and as Jeff said, it's reliable. And if you look at a lot of the, I'm thinking the Lakes region particularly, but maybe also Hampton Beach, a lot of what had been transient lodging has been turned into condominiums, the little cottage colonies and whatnot. So now more and more of our tourism in the Lakes region, for example, is people who basically live there sort of like in the summer. So they don't hit all the tourist activities, the water slides, the pinball arcades, more likely to eat inside the unit than at restaurants.
Oh, that's
interesting.
But when
a Canadian comes... Yeah. Canadian visitors come, I think their spending patterns are much different. They do eat in restaurants. They do go on the water slide. They do take part in the amusement aspects of it. So I think it's important support for that segment of the tourism industry that otherwise wouldn't be as strong.
Okay, so bienvenue Canadians, right?
To
the Lakes region. Go ahead, Jeff.
I just want to say one other effect of this budding trade war we're having with Canada, especially if it keeps going, is that I've noticed that the Canadian dollar, the loonie, has been lessening in value to the dollar. So that means if someone comes from Canada to spend money here, they have less money to spend, or
that's
it's going to be more
a bigger impact than any little
exactly.
dispute
so
between politicians. Yeah.
So that could have an impact.
Because their dollar
even if they still might be coming, they might be spending less.
Sure.
And that will definitely have an effect on.
Okay. On the other hand, I have two Canadian fives in my wallet right now from
a
trip
a
while ago.
Right now.
Thinking,
because they're losing
money. I should do something with them. One last really important aspect to us here in New Hampshire about this flow of international goods, finance, and people. And Brian, I'll start with you because you're near UNH. international students. As you know, many New Hampshire colleges and universities are looking at foreign students, not just to diversify their campuses, but to help pay the bills, because foreigners often pay full freight for tuition. You don't need to give them financial aid. UNH just announced expanded outreach to Chinese students this week. So how are higher education leaders viewing this overall sort of negative international commerce environment?
I think with a lot of trepidation, and with good reason, because if you look at the numbers, the number of student visas, F1, J1 student visas in the U.S. increased by about 60% between 2010 and 2016. In the last year, 2017, they actually dropped.
Now,
so that's a real, you know, some of it has to do with the price increasing in the U.S., but this is a huge issue for a long-term issue. The demand for higher education worldwide is increasing dramatically. China is the number one exporter of students to the world. And that's at a time when the U.S. demand for higher education is declining. So these international students are absolutely critical to maintaining the infrastructure of higher education. Beyond that, they're a great potential source of labor and high skill, higher percentage of STEM students. Study by Brookings Institution in 2014 indicated that about 45% of students who come with these visas to study in the U.S., about 45% of them apply to extend those to work in the area that they went to college.
Well, and here in northern New England, and we've done multiple shows on this, these small rural colleges, you know, are facing both changing tastes of younger people. They maybe don't want to be in these little tiny places, even though they're beautiful. And also, we just have fewer young people in this region. So colleges and universities, Brian, you're saying, are really looking to this foreign population.
Absolutely. It's the market. That's where the market is expanding. It's internationally. It's not within the U.S. Eventually, that will change, and we'll see some increases. But worldwide is where the increasing demand. If they don't come to the U.S., they're going to go to Canada. They're going to go to Australia. They'll go somewhere in Europe. But, you know, we have the opportunity. And right now we're kind of shooting ourselves in the foot by the messages that we're sending.
Well, you mentioned student visas. And in just a moment, we're going to talk about a different type of visa, H-2B visas. These are the temporary work visas that allow lots of young foreigners to come and work in our, you know, coffee shops and ice cream shops and pizza places and suntan lotion stands in the summertime. But let's go to our listeners, gentlemen. Again, you can send us an email. It's our New Hampshire Economic Roundup, and we'd love to hear from you. We're spending some time looking at the impact of international commerce, the flow of trade, goods, finances, people, and the impact right here in the Granite State. Let's get your questions in, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Joshua's calling from Norwich. Hi, Joshua, you're on the air. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
Good morning, Joshua. Go ahead.
My comment was, when the Japanese company bought the ball bearing plant in New Hampshire, what they did was they injected additional capital into the U.S. economy and potentially the New Hampshire economy. When they did that, whoever they bought the company from received that additional capital and could redeploy it into other manufacturing enterprises potentially. Foreign ownership of U.S. companies is a good thing, as it makes the available capital for our economies to grow more abundant.
Well, Joshua, thank you for the call. And Russ, you were the one who brought up that example. And partly in answer to my question, okay, people hear foreign investment in American companies, and some people might say, ooh, that's not so good. But here's Joshua saying, no, this is important.
Yeah, I mean, I've been New Hampshire Ball Bearings is about 200 yards from where I live.
Oh, really?
So I've been following, you know, I've been around the firm for a long time. I have good friends that work there. It's been a great working environment since the Japanese acquired it. It was a good working environment before. It's great. The technology that they have is unbelievable. If you walk into New Hampshire Ball Bearings and you look in a large room, everybody's on a cathode ray tube looking at a computer monitor. I thought that was the accounting department. That's the manufacturing department. They're controlling all the high-tech manufacturing operations. So there's no question that in most instances, when a foreign buyer purchases, just as Joshua said, there's new capital infused. And in my experience, it's been a good thing for the firms that have been acquired. BAE Systems is doing tremendous good things for the state.
That's owned by the British?
Yes.
Yeah, and that's a company often lauded for being, you know, a great employer and good jobs
high
and
technology,
good
paying. Great. So a lot of it's good. But at the same time, as I said, it's still true that some of the upper management is displaced when there is a foreign takeover. On balance, looking at that specific firm that I raised and Joshua commented on, I think it's a good thing. It's been a good thing.
Well, Joshua, thank you for the call. And again, you can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. And gentlemen, let's talk about summer employment, including the foreign element to that, but there's a lot more to it. And Jeff, to you first, how much do New Hampshire's employment needs increase in the summer?
Oh, they
it's our biggest tourist season.
Absolutely, absolutely, and that generates thousands of jobs, you know, part time, seasonal jobs, and a lot of it has historically been younger people working in the summer,
college students,
high school students, and what the interesting thing is it reflects the larger workforce problems we're having because there are fewer of them, and there's a lot of job openings. And I'll tell you a story just over this past weekend. My wife and I and our dog took a little drive down to Sunapee, and we saw an ice cream place there and said, let's go get some ice cream. So the line was really long. I said, wow, this is really doing great, right? But it was because the owner was taking the orders and filling the orders. So he had no one working with him, no one working for him. This is on a weekend. I assume it's because school still isn't out. But that was really it was eye-opening.
Yeah.
It took about almost a half an hour to get an ice cream cone.
I've heard similar stories. A neighbor of mine went to this cafe in a nearby town, and she said it took like an hour and a half to get lunch, you know, and the people apologized, but they said, we just don't have enough people to wait on you. You kind of wish they'd put that sign up on the door before you sit down. But anyway, go ahead, Russ.
I was going to say, it's a very significant issue because the unemployment rate generally is so low already that if you put on constraints on the these summer visas that are allowed, it can be a real problem for certain firms. The economy as a whole, maybe not. A friend of mine runs a business with probably, I'm thinking, maybe 300 rooms of lodging. And he said, I just can't get anybody. He said, last year I had 20 people. This year I'm getting only 4. He said, I have my wife making beds. This is a multi-million dollar operation because I can't get anybody to make them. There are certain firms that use the H-2B visas.
These are the foreign, temporary workers.
That usually students that come and work for the summer from primarily maybe Eastern Europe, I think, to a great degree. And they recently, the number of visas were bumped by 15,000. Nationally, it's about 85,000 of these visas are issued. It was bumped by 15,000.
Because there were so many complaints from summer businesses,
exactly.
Including Senator Shaheen, who said, some restaurants last year had to close a couple days a week because they just couldn't find enough people.
Yeah, and as I said, if you load limitations on top of a 2%, 2.5% unemployment rate, it's really a burden for those firms that had come to rely on foreign students to come in and help out during the summer months. And it's great for the students. I think it's great for America. It's a public relations thing.
So, but what about American students, Brian? College students, high school students? I mean, why aren't they taking these summer
jobs?
Well,
they are. They're certainly taking them. The situation is there's just fewer of those younger people to take the jobs. Historically, that has been such a large part of the hospitality industry's employment base and young people in general. Of all people 18 and under in New Hampshire that have a job, almost 40% of them are employed in either the lodging, restaurant, or recreation industry. So it's pretty close to half. So, that's a big part of the workforce. There's fewer of those people out there. And 61% of the workforce in those industries is under age 35, compared to 21% overall in New Hampshire. So we know demographically that segment of the population has declined. So you know what's going to happen to the lodging, restaurant, and recreation industries. So we've layered on an awfully big problem. This H-2B issue just adds another element of the difficulty to those industries.
Let me remind our listeners again that you can join us. Again, if you're an employer looking for summer help, we're talking about you right now, so you can join us. Or if you're someone looking for summer work, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call like Joshua did, 1-800-892-6477. Go ahead, Jeff Feingold.
I was going to say that something that Brian mentioned earlier about the need for we need foreign students to come into the colleges in our state and elsewhere to keep them going, basically. The same is true in terms of our hospitality industry. And it also says, I think, just in New Hampshire in general, for our population, it's really important for us to remember that if we allow more immigration into the state, that helps bring the age down and brings us a source of younger people who want to work, willing to work, and able to work. And that's something that I don't think we think about too much in the big scheme of things. With all the talk about limiting immigration, it's not a good thing for New Hampshire in terms of our population.
Go ahead, Russ.
Yeah, I think, as you know, I volunteer teach in Vietnam, and I think that I could move any one of my classes in entirety to an educational institution in New Hampshire, but for the financial constraints and the immigration constraints. We have to recognize that our educational system is the world standard. And so there's almost unlimited demand, the only constraint being income and earnings, the ability to pay, because we can't afford to give everybody a scholarship. Yeah. But the United States educational system, particularly at the college level, but even at the high school level, is just the gold standard for the rest of the world. So we can bring a lot of people in.
So talking about, again, homegrown talent, and all of you have said, especially you, Brian, that, you know, teenagers and college students are doing these jobs. There's just fewer of them. As more of our companies here in New Hampshire are bought up by national chains, and we're going to talk about that in our next segment, do you think that they are getting sort of fussier about who they hire? For example, national rules say we can only hire 18-year-olds. Well, in New Hampshire, could we please hire a 17-year-old or a 16-year-old? You know, I've found that looking around, helping my older son try and find jobs when he turned 16. He was really excited, find a job. And a lot of these chains were like, nah, sorry, 18 and up.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, my 16-year-old can make a sandwich. He can do it. What do you think, Brian? Yeah, these sort of rules that apply nationally maybe don't apply here
absolutely.
In the state.
Absolutely. I think, you know, labor markets are unique. And companies that have that, you know, read from the textbook from their corporate office will find that when they come to New Hampshire,
right.
The situation is going to be dramatically different. Yeah, there's absolutely no doubt that we have to look to be more flexible in a lot of different ways. You know, when you talk about the hospitality industry, I know one of the issues is, you know, we start our schools, a lot of them, before Labor Day, which is just an absolutely critical, hospitality season. And so when that happens, we lose a good portion of our workforce. Again, 40% of people age under 18 who are working in hospitality industries. And so when they go back to school before Labor Day, it becomes a real issue. Of the districts that don't do it, that don't close before Labor, a lot of them are in areas where there's strong hospitality industries.
Well, and Governor Sununu opened that can of worms last year and got a lot of support for it from hospitality businesses, but it didn't end up going anywhere. So maybe we can pick up that thread after a short break. Lots more to talk about as well, including, as we alluded to, merger mania, national companies buying up smaller companies here in the Granite State, how that's working out. All that's coming up, plus your phone calls at 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our program, an Exchange fan favorite, our annual Summer Book Show. Be sure to join us for that tomorrow morning, live at 9. This hour, it's the New Hampshire Economic Roundup, a monthly look at the top economic headlines affecting our state. Now, we've been talking about trade, foreign investment here in New Hampshire, how that affects the Granite State, especially given the trade disputes that have been erupting recently. We've been looking at summer employment as well, the role of college and high school students, but also the increasing role of foreign students on what are called H-2B visas. We'd love to hear from you again. The number 1-800-892-6477. And Jeff, Brian, and Russ, let's go back to our listeners. And Molly's joining us from Conway. Hi, Molly. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. The thing that I have is I moved here to the state 9 months ago.
Oh, welcome, Molly.
And I'm a college graduate, recent, and I had hoped to secure more permanent, you know, work-ready job, something that I can move up in and have a career in. And I ended up picking up 4 part-time swing shift basic jobs because there wasn't so much work-ready jobs and everybody needed help in, like, hospitality. I do housekeeping, cleaning houses. I'm working for a bunch of small businesses that just can't find people.
You know, go ahead, Molly.
I guess it really is a shortage around, at least where I'm at here, of people that can do the basic jobs.
So,
and not so much long on jobs for people that are looking for careers.
Well, Molly, I'm so glad you called. And Conway is definitely a big, big tourist region. And Brian, I think she's getting at something important, though. You know, you have bigger career hopes. At the same time, you need to pay the bills. So you pick up 2 or 3 or 4, wow, Molly, part-time jobs. And then who has time to focus on those bigger career hopes?
Yeah, I mean, Molly gets at a real issue in the state, which is the concentration of the jobs, the kind of jobs that I assume she's looking for, those career track opportunities, you know, where you have the opportunity to earn a middle class and higher wage and move up. Those jobs are increasingly, unfortunately, being concentrated in a few areas of the state, the Seacoast, Manchester, the Upper Valley, and the Hanover, Lebanon area in particular.
Concord, Nashua.
And so unless you happen to have the resources to move or the desire to move to more of the metropolitan areas, it's very difficult to find the kind of jobs that I think she's looking at. And that makes it difficult to attract young, college-educated individuals to those regions of the state.
Sure, people who want those types of jobs. But if you're a sort of avid hiker or a mountain biker, maybe you want to live in Conway.
Or if you're a lone eagle. You know, what's great, if you've got the ability to work from home like I do and sit at a computer and do my analyses, you can live anywhere in the state. So if you've got the kind of job that allows you to the flexibility to work from home or to contact your customers, whatever, then you can do it. But other than that, if you're working for a corporation, it's very difficult.
Well, Molly, good luck to you, and thank you for calling in. Go ahead,
yeah,
Jeff.
I just want to say this is part of the a bigger discussion that maybe we could have some other time, but I think part of the problem is that the reason those jobs are being concentrated down in the southern part of the state mostly is because that's where the people are, which means that's where the workers are. And I think it's been a real problem for the North Country. I sat down with several North Country White Mountains area business owners recently, and that's what they were basically bemoaning. There's no people up there. They don't have workers. So when there's limited number of workers, businesses aren't going to be setting up there. And actually, there's been occasions where in the Laconia area, lost a pretty major employer that had good jobs. I forget.
UTech,
and they moved down to, I believe, Londonderry. Because that's where the people are.
Yeah, Londonderry's booming, and we've talked about that on this program.
And this is the kind of thing that's happening. And you know, it's like, how do you solve this? It's a dilemma.
You got to flip the economic development upside down. For a long time, we thought it was all about attracting companies. Yeah. It's really now about attracting people.
That's exactly
because
right.
Because where there are people, and particularly skilled, well-educated people, those are the areas that are going to see more robust economic growth. So we've got to convince communities and regions that they ought to be paying attention to what they're doing to attract individuals as much as what they're doing to attract businesses.
Go ahead, Russ.
Yeah, I was going to say, I did some work in Conway on the Technology Center, looking at the feasibility of it, and did some national contacting to find out, okay, can technology exist in a rural area? Because as Brian said, if you're working from home, you're on a computer. You can be anywhere.
If you have good internet access.
Yeah, yeah. Well, okay.
Which is a problem
presuming
in parts
that,
of New
that's
Hampshire.
True. It is a problem.
A big problem.
What happens is the technology firms don't want to move to a place like Conway because not only can they not hire somebody initially, but if somebody leaves, there's not a pool to fill the vacancies.
Oh, so, I see. So if 20, you know, young, educated people move to Conway to work for this great company and the company leaves, you've got these 20 people with nowhere to go
actually,
but Nashua. Or
it's actually even the opposite as well, Laura. If you hire 20 people and three of them leave in Conway, you have a very difficult time filling those slots.
I see.
Once you've geared up, you have a lot of movement, particularly in the technology sector. And there's no labor pool to pull from. Whereas if you're in Nashua, you get a million people around.
Although
you.
The amenities in those areas are beautiful. I mean, let's
absolutely
be
right.
Yeah. It's lovely. So if you'd like to get outside, it's all there for you.
Perfect.
It's right there.
Well, there's an interesting possible experiment happening in Laconia that's starting right now. The use of the property, the former Laconia State School property. And one of the uses, and I know the mayor is big on this, is to really build housing there because it's a beautiful piece of property, mixed use stuff, you know, and I think it would be affordable housing and then more luxury housing, just turn it into a major housing area because that's been a problem in Laconia in the first place. And the second thing is to attract people because Laconia has been losing population over many years now. And his idea is that if you have people, then businesses will come to what Brian was saying, to Brian's point. And that's really what it's going to be. It seems like they're headed in that direction in Laconia.
It's so much easier, though, for politicians to talk about, let's bring jobs. I mean, I've been doing this Race for the First series where we interview a candidate from the first congressional district because there are, I think, a baker's dozen at this point. Yeah. And, you know, week after week, people come in and say, you know, we need to create jobs or attract businesses. And it's a lot easier to say, hey, I helped this company come in than it is to sort of say, Brian, I'm going to go to you, than to say, I was responsible for enticing five people or six people. I mean, because people have complicated lives. So it's not as easy a sell or a thing to talk about.
I did a presentation to some realtors a couple of weeks ago. And I said, caveat here, I am not hired by this person, not paid by this person. I said the best economic developer in the state is Eric Chinberg. He's a builder who goes in and renovates mill buildings and creates the kind of housing that a lot of young people and people with skills want to live in. And he has done more for downtown areas in Newmarket, in Dover. He's going to be doing it in Somersworth.
I got to get over to Dover, Brian, because I hear about so many good things happening there.
It changes the dynamic of the community. Helps change the dynamic of a community just by offering the kinds of housing that younger people and people with skills want to have. And it creates a different dynamic in the downtown, and it makes the whole community look more attractive to employers as a potential for labor pool. So that's, you know, he does not get the credit as an economic developer, but in fact, he's played a significant role in developing communities.
Go ahead, Russ.
I'm starting to see a shifting landscape within the planning community, the professional planning community in the state, wherein in the past, housing was seen as a detriment because you had kids. And if you had kids, you had to educate the kids, you know. So now I think there is, not everywhere, but particularly in the larger communities in the state, there is a sense that we need housing. Mm-hmm. As Jeff talked about
and
in
Laconia.
And please
bring the kids.
We don't have enough kids. We don't have enough workers. Maybe housing's a solution instead of a problem.
Well, and we were talking about summer employment, and then we, you know, which is related to this broader employment shortage. But Gene says, in terms of summer employment, don't forget about small farms. Many of them have to go without because of labor shortages. And I've read about this nationally as well, that, you know, the strawberries are ready to be picked, whether you got the workers or not. So I hear what you're saying, Gene. Thank you for the email. Here's another one from Brian in Bartlett, who says, we are hearing, and I see it in the businesses around here, that there are no workers to hire. Yet every time we have an election, we hear politicians bemoaning the job situation. We need to bring more jobs to X region. Brian says. Are these just political scare tactics, or do we really need more jobs, or do we need more higher-paying jobs? That relates to what our caller said earlier. Unemployment is low, yet many areas of the state are having economic difficulties. The two messages can seem conflicted. Brian, real thoughtful. I really appreciate it. And Jeff, you know, this relates to a lot of what we've been talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, one of the things I have to say is that it is interesting when you hear politicians talking about we need more jobs. Well, actually, in New Hampshire, as we've talked about on this show for a long time now, we don't need more jobs. We need more people. And a perfect example is BAE Systems down in Nashua. They have openings, apparently, right now for 500 workers. They need 500 workers to fill jobs. Then those are good-paying, really good-paying jobs. And they're still having trouble finding people to fill those jobs. And the same is true as other high-tech and manufacturing companies that have good-paying jobs. The problem is that the people in, let's say, Conway or Bartlett or whatever, you know, are they going to commute down to Nashua to take that job? Probably not. But what they might happen is there are a certain number of people in that part of the state who say, you know what, I can't do it up here anymore. I'm moving down to Nashua because I can get a job down there. And that's what's dangerous. And that's what's been hurting the North Country for a long time now.
Well, Brian, thank you for the email. And here's another one from Ethan in Sugar Hill, who says, although many smaller colleges are struggling to attract international students, international boarding school populations are booming from Tilton, Holderness, the White Mountain School, St. Paul's, everywhere. The demographic makeup of New Hampshire boarding schools is definitely global, Ethan says. Japanese students in the 90s, Koreans in the 2000s, and Chinese today. These international students and their families are still very interested in U.S. education. So that gets to our earlier conversation about schools bringing in. We talk about colleges, but Ethan's right. International students are definitely making an appearance at boarding schools as well. So, Ethan, thank you for that. You know, gentlemen, we can only hit on this quickly, but Russ, I do want to turn to you because it kind of, again, relates to everything we've been talking about today. And that's merger mania here in New Hampshire. Lots of coverage about mergers nationally this week. Big, big headlines, especially in the media and entertainment industry. But here in New Hampshire, what sectors of our economy, Russ, seem to be especially active in terms of, you know, merging or commingling or whatever you want to call it?
I think the number one is probably banking. If you go back to the 1990s, 1998, we had 38, in effect, homegrown banks in New Hampshire. We're down to 14 now.
Wow. Say that again.
38 in 1998 and 14 now.
Is that necessarily bad? Maybe these bigger banks stronger and more able to lend more widely.
Yeah, there are pluses and minuses for sure, Laura. But I think that I look at my area, Laconia, where we at one time we had five or six banks. We basically have one now that's a homegrown bank, Bank of New Hampshire. The rest have kind of been absorbed by larger institutions. What does that mean in a community that has 15,000 people or a county with 60,000 people? It means you have fewer bank presidents. You have fewer bank vice presidents. You have fewer chief financial officers, so that the upper middle class gets decimated. And instead of having all of those positions, what you have is a branch manager, which is a good job, no doubt about it. But nonetheless, it has hurt the social fabric of my community. Now, maybe in Manchester, when TD takes over or another bank takes over, it's not as big. But in smaller communities, it can have, a big impact on the economy, on Little League baseball team sponsorship.
Right. Those banks are good about underwriting local teams.
Rotary Club membership, right, and the good things that Rotary Clubs do. So I think it's a mixed blessing. On the positive side, it's very hard for a small bank to stay viable in the wake of Dodd-Frank regulations and the tremendous technology demands that it takes to run a bank today. Every bank, all of us want to be able to use our cell phone to access our bank account and do a lot of our banking relationships, particularly younger people. And it's hard for a small bank to do that.
To keep up with all the changes that people expect.
Tremendous economies of scale in banking that that encourage larger institutions, which means fewer choice for consumers.
Fewer choice of provider, but more choice of services within those providers.
I think that's true.
You're saying about the social fabric of a community and some of the sort of high-level white-collar jobs that go away.
Yeah, it's been a burden, I think, in I know in the Lakes region, I feel the difference.
Something else that's affecting smaller banks that has affected them is the low interest rates that we've had for many years now. And that's a way of their income is just not the same as it was. And that's why one of the things that's moving this whole idea of consolidation. We've seen so many of them just in the last few years just basically be consolidated, eaten up by other banks.
Well, another sector that has seen a lot of merger mania is the healthcare sector, hospitals and so forth. But we're almost out of time, so I'm going to set that aside and just ask you guys in our last minute or so, Brian, you first, please, to look ahead over the next couple of weeks before we meet again. What economic reports, numbers, trends, especially as they concern New Hampshire, Brian, will you be looking at?
I'm going to be looking at today the employment report, payroll employment for May will be released today, along with labor
for New Hampshire or for
New Hampshire, yeah. Along with the labor force. We have been adding jobs at a higher rate than I expected we would have been able to, about 1.3 annualized, much higher than our labor force growth. At the same time, our unemployment rate has been steady at 2.6. Something's happening out there. This is my task. Find out what's happening. A couple of reasons that could explain it. One, people who had been working in another state who are part of our labor force maybe are increasingly working in New Hampshire, you know, coming back. That's one way. The other way is people who are counted in another state's labor force are now working in New Hampshire. That's the only way that these things could be reconciled, that we could have 1.3% job growth annualized and only 0.3 or 0.4% labor force growth and not have a change in our unemployment rate. We have to be recapturing some of our labor or capturing some other state's labor. And I'm going to sort that out over the next several months.
Okay, well, figure it out and come back because that's really interesting.
I think I'm going to look at inflation nationally and what the impact that has on interest rates. The Fed's going to raise interest rates this week. It's in a nutshell.
And that'll affect housing, and we should definitely talk about housing.
And I just piggyback on Brian. Job growth in New Hampshire, is it going to be constrained because we don't have enough labor?
Well, and what kind of jobs? Again, as our caller from Conway told us, you know, she's got four jobs, but she doesn't sound thrilled with any of them.
She probably needs four jobs, given
what
they pay.
Right. Yeah, right. Go ahead.
Well, first of all, I'm anxious to see what Canada's response is on these tariffs and what they're going to impose and whether it affects New Hampshire businesses specifically. The other thing is that we're doing our annual mid-year review of the economy, and for our next issue, and we're just trying to talk to a bunch of people and see what's going on.
Okay. And
when's
that
coming
out, Jeff?
It's coming out in our June 22nd issue.
Okay. So lots to talk about next time. Thank you, guys. Always interesting. I really appreciate you being here. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.